dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, and Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. We've been talking now for quite some time, but I think perhaps with increasing urgency, about a part of the battle space, indeed the very front lines of the war for the free world, that involves our friend, our ally, our much valued fellow member of the free world, namely Israel, in a very dangerous moment. That danger seems to be intensifying, and we're going to talk first with our friend Yoram Ettinger, a man who has served Israel in senior ambassadorial and other diplomatic posts. He has been, among other things, the commentator par excellence on what is going on both on that side of the pond and ours, currently under the rubric of a project he calls Second Thought, a U.S.-Israel initiative, which he directs. He is also the author of a terrific resource. It's called The Ettinger Report, and I recommend it to all of you, theettingerreport.com. Mr. Ambassador, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It is great to have you with us for a long overdue but much needed assessment of where we are.
Thank you very much.
We have been treated in recent days, if that's the right word for it, to reporting about conversations that the Secretary of State, John Kerry, had with your Prime Minister, Bibi Netanyahu, over the weekend in Geneva, the substance of which, according to these reports, has been kind of threatening towards Israel, something that you wouldn't think would be coming from a friend and ally like the United States. What do you know, what do you think is going on at the moment in terms of both what Kerry is saying the Europeans might do to Israel if there isn't a peace deal, and for that matter, what the Obama administration might do if there isn't one by January?
It seems to me that there is an unbridgeable gap between the position of Israel and that of the White House or the Department of State. And the huge difference, unbridgeable gap, has to do with the assumption in Washington on the administration side that the Palestinian issue is the core cause of Middle East turbulence. And the derivative of that very erroneous assumption has been an undue pressure on Israel. John Kerry is here for the eighth time, and that reflects his focus on the Palestinian issue, while the area is tumultuous. And it is in a major, major, big disarray because of other issues. But for John Kerry, it's the Palestinian issue, which supposedly is the crown jewel of Arab politics. And he assumes that in order to get Arab support, Middle Eastern support for American policies, somehow he must deliver on the Palestinian issue. In a very brief manner, nothing which has happened in the last 3.5 years on the Arab street, the Arab tsunami from Libya and Tunisia and Egypt, Bahrain and Mauritania and Syria and around the corner Jordan and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, nothing has to do directly or indirectly with the Palestinian issue. Arabs do not take the Palestinian issue to be their centerpiece of policy. They do not shower the Palestinians with resources, only with rhetoric. That's, by the way, the reason why John Kerry comes up with an idea of providing the Palestinians with $4 billion emergency assistance, while the Arabs don't do that, because they don't consider it to be central to their policy. The bottom line is, while the U.S. is smothered by major little sandstorms from Egypt and Syria and Iran primarily, John Kerry is dealing with some tumbleweeds on the road, tumbleweeds such as the Palestinian issue.
But let me ask you, Ambassador Yoram Medinger, what is being reported is that in the insistent demand on the part of John Kerry and presumably President Obama, the Obama administration more generally, that Israel move this process along. It sounds as though it's being given basically an ultimatum. If you do not, we will dictate terms to you. We will use, among other things, the pressure of our European allies on you economically in terms of isolating you and otherwise undermining your country and government, that will make this an irresistible demand. How is that being seen in Israel at the moment? Do you think it will work? And having, as you know, just come back myself from Israel and seen firsthand, again, the vital strategic territory that Israel is being told it must surrender to the Palestinians in the absence of any evidence that it will do anything other than translate into a yet another terrorist state in Israel's midst, can this possibly translate to anything remotely like peace?
Well, certainly the expectation that Israel would concede the mountain ridges of Judea and Samaria is divorced from reality, especially against the backdrop of the turmoil in the Middle East, which has intensified uncertainty and volatility and unpredictability. And in that new environment, certainly you need much more security rather than less security. If the U.S. does impose certain undue pressure hardships on Israel, it seems to me that the question is not only how would it play in Israel, but how would it play in the U.S. As far as I know, on Capitol Hill, there is a realization that in light of the Arab tsunami, Israel is depicted increasingly as the only viable and capable and predictable and stable and economically and commercially capable and democratic and unconditional ally of the U.S. There is a growing realization on Capitol Hill, and I believe in the U.S. at large, that at a time when the U.S. retreats from Iraq and Afghanistan, at a time when the U.S. cuts drastically its defense budget and capabilities, at a time when the threats are mounting and the Russians and the Chinese are deepening their penetration into the area, there is only Israel which can extend the strategic hand of the U.S., and therefore anybody who pressures Israel, in fact, is imposing upon the U.S. potential strategic damages. And last and not least, if that happens, to be realistic, it ain't the first time, ain't the last time, ain't the worst time. We prevailed. A series of undue pressure by different presidents and different secretaries of state, and we prevailed mostly because of our own determination, but equally speaking, because of much more, much better understanding by the U.S. Congress and the U.S. Constituent.
Yeah. Joram Edinger, I couldn't agree more that that's the past record. It's one that I hope will continue to be the case as Israel confronts not only, as you say, a neighborhood that is in tumult, but increasing pressure from Israel. And I certainly hope that, as you've said, based on long experience with Capitol Hill during your previous incarnation here in Washington with the Embassy of Israel, Ambassador Edinger, that that Congress will stand with Israel, as do, I think, the American people, unquestionably. We look forward to further conversations about all of this at a portentous time, needless to say, and our hopes are with you and your countrymen, and that counsel like yours will be heard and attended to by the Bowman administration. Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. Keep up the great work on Second Thoughts, and the EdingerReport.com is required reading, folks. Check it out. Next up, Jim Hansen joins us to talk about the hollowing out of the military and purges in its senior ranks. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Jim Hansen, the guy who gives us here at Secure Freedom Radio our boots-on-the-ground perspective on all of the major national security challenges and debates that we're having. It's a very welcome perspective, which he comes to via his time in the Special Forces of the United States Army. He is also a commentator at Black5.net, and he helped co-found a marvelous organization, the Warrior Legacy Foundation. Jim Hansen, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Always a pleasure, Frank.
Listen, let's start with the speech that Chuck Hagel, the Secretary of Defense, made at the Center for Strategic and International Studies this week. He basically laid out the kind of, get used to it message that I think he certainly seems to be happy to convey, if not happy, at least willing to convey, rather than, you know, fighting tooth and tongue against the effects of sequestration, the kinds of cuts that are now, I would argue, really seriously hollowing out our armed forces. He laid out six priorities that he has in mind having the military use to accommodate itself to the reality that just for the foreseeable future, it's going to be suffering these disproportionate and ill-advised cuts. They involve institutional reform, revisions to force planning, preparing for a prolonged readiness challenge, and that's an understatement, protecting investments, balance among the various services and capabilities, and personnel and compensation policy, by which he means apparently some significant cuts. We'll talk about each of them in turn a little bit, but just your general thoughts, Jim, as to what this means for the military if the Secretary of Defense is saying, get used to it.
Well, I think it means that obviously the planet has gotten much, much safer.
You know, oh, yeah.
All of our peace seem to have given up their ambitions. There will be no more regional conflicts where we, as the only policemen of the world, have to respond to. And we can all get back to prosperity at home with the booming economy that Obama's given us.
Okay, that sounds just perfect. I know you're being facetious in saying that, Jim Hansen, but talk a little bit about what it would mean, in your judgment, if these kinds of cuts persist and if these kinds of adjustments are now going to be simply a given for the foreseeable future.
You know, Frank, one of the reasons to spend money on defense is not so that you can drive tanks anywhere you want to. It's so that you don't have to. And I think that's something this administration is sorely lacking in the strategic thinking to be able to comprehend. They don't get it. I mean, they don't understand what a long war is. They don't understand strategy. They understand campaigning. They understand, you know, giving speeches. They don't understand implementing any kind of policy. So easy for them to say, we can make these massive cuts. It won't be a problem because we're not going to go ahead and have to deploy anywhere. They've decided they're not going to fight any wars, so therefore there won't be any. Problem is, the Russians are holding the biggest war games they have since the Cold War. They're testing their nuclear-capable missiles. The Chinese are making all kinds of threats about where exactly they would nuke us if they decide that's what they want to do. The Iranians are about to finish their bomb. The North Koreans are busy helping them and proliferating any place else they can. And none of those things are deterred one ounce by a weakened, hollowed out American military, and yet that's what we're doing.
Well, and to the contrary, I think as we talk about most weeks, Jim, the actual practical effect of their perceptions of our weakness is only to embolden them further, and probably others besides. Jim, before we dwell down on some of the practical implications of all this, talk a little bit about, as a guy who's spent time in uniform, what it would likely mean to an all-volunteer force that is being stretched thin, that has been overworked, that is being subjected to inadequate training and equipping, if the personnel cuts, costs are escalating. There's no getting around that. But if personnel costs, health care benefits of other kinds are going to be on the chopping block as well, is that likely to make it even more problematic for the all-volunteer force to continue to operate?
Without a doubt, Frank. I mean, the bottom line is there needs to be a level of trust between people you're asking to risk their lives and leave their families for long periods of time and the amount of support you give them to do that. You know, nobody joins the military to get rich. It doesn't happen. But you do have an expectation that you and your family will be taken care of. And from what Chuck Hagel said, that's not really a priority for this administration. And I think that's disgraceful. That will hurt morale. That will hurt recruiting. That will hurt retention. And most importantly, that will hurt operational readiness and our ability to actually fight when, as it seems much more likely, we're probably going to have to since we're not busy deterring anyone. So all around, bad ideas poorly implemented.
Jim, I don't know that you were in the service back when they hollowed it out the last time during the Carter years and to a lesser degree the Clinton years, but you certainly know from the corporate memory that you bring to this as do your colleagues, comrades in arms, and former veterans, that one of the characteristics of this has been a kind of triaged readiness. As they call it. Some units are said to be fully ready. Others, it'll take a week or more to get them ready to go. Maybe others, 3 months. Ships that aren't deployable without considerable lead times and so on. Just again, as a practical guy with firsthand hard military experience, what does it mean to a unit if it is maintained indefinitely in an unready status, not just in terms of its ability to go fight, obviously, but in terms of morale and those other intangibles for the forces that are asked to serve in it?
It's a question of reality, Frank. I mean, the military guy serving on the ground and woman serving on the ground doesn't have the option of believing whatever the PowerPoint presentations and the Excel spreadsheets say. They deal with the reality as it actually occurs. That means there's a huge difference between training with live rounds in a live fire exercise and doing a tabletop demonstration for visiting congressmen. We're going to be doing a lot more dog and pony shows and goat rodeos for Congress critters to prove to them that we haven't actually heard anything than we are going to be doing actual training. And that's going to get people killed when, as is inevitable, the next conflict flares up, the world dials 911, and we got to roll ourselves into that conflict. It's not helpful at all.
Well, and again, it comes back to the point you were making a moment ago. Indeed, in part because of these kinds of actions and decisions, the world is becoming a more dangerous place, meaning that it is that much more likely that that 911 call will be coming in. Jim, lastly, and we only have about a minute, but there are these persistent reports that large numbers of senior military personnel, disproportionately large numbers, are being cashiered by the Obama administration. I know you're of the view that we've got too many general officers, but is there a pattern emerging, and should we be concerned about it?
You know, Frank, one thing, I've actually taken a look since the last time we talked to see who's gone and why they were pushed out or removed. And from at least what is showing on the surface, and I haven't had a chance to drill down at all of them, but there is an awful lot of wrongdoing being punished. Now, I think also there is selective prosecution. That's one thing that in an administration and in a bureaucracy, you have the choice of who you want to go after. I think there may be some reality in the idea that there is targeting, but I haven't seen anybody who's been particularly egregiously, you know, prosecuted for something they shouldn't have done. The people who are being pushed out did things wrong. And holding them accountable is as necessary for morale as anything else. Is the administration doing it, targeting it? They may be, but I haven't seen a big indication of it.
We need to drill down on this further, and I look forward to doing so with you, Jim Hansen. Thank you for taking the time to join us. As always, it's good to talk with you. We'll do it again soon. Next up, a veteran officer of the National Security Agency talks about what's happening to our intelligence capabilities as a result of the NSA scandals and what it means for you. Straight ahead.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Yeah.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, intelligent talk.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Recent press reports say one of Barack Obama's top goals for his second term is brokering a peace deal between Israelis and Palestinians. But if negotiations fail, he is said to be willing to impose his preferred outcome on the Israelis. Until now, Republican and Democratic presidents alike have refused to foist a so-called peace agreement on Israel that was unacceptable to our most important Mideast ally. What makes Obama's approach so dangerous is that the concessions demanded of Israel would require her to surrender strategic real estate with potentially suicidal results. It empowers Israel's enemies and ours. The Obama gambit would reinforce the world's perception that it is better to be America's enemy than its friend, and that is a formula for inciting conflict with more foes and fewer allies. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're joined by John Schindler. He is a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College, where he teaches courses on security, strategy, intelligence, terrorism, and military history. Interestingly, and particularly helpful for the present purpose, is he spent nearly a decade with the National Security Agency as an intelligence analyst and counterintelligence officer, a man, in short, who has a very, very firsthand perspective, I'm sure, on the Edward Snowden affair and the revelations, quite damaging, as we'll be discussing, of his files, his computer hard drives out of the National Security Agency. John is also the author, most recently, of The Terrorist Perspectives Project, Strategic and Operational Perspectives of Al-Qaeda. John, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you for your past service to our country and that you're continuing to render at the War College. Great to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be here. Very excited to be here.
You have, as I say, a kind of firsthand sense, I'm sure, of the damage that Edward Snowden has done. Our colleague Michelle Van Cleave, former counterintelligence executive to President Bush, has written about this for the center's website. But tell us a little bit about your perspective and how serious you think the damage will prove to be.
I think we're in sort of uncharted waters here, Frank, honestly. I think the intelligence community, of course, of history, unfortunately, has had a parade of traitors, even defectors. But I think this is a rare thing where you have a truly global media campaign piggybacked, not unintentionally, by the way, piggybacked on top of our defector, Mr. Snowden, to create truly massive political damage for the United States, even above and beyond the, frankly, vast intelligence damage. This is something that is new. Some of the tendencies are not new, but the extent of this is new, and this requires a more energetic response than we're getting.
John, did I hear you say an unintentional press campaign or intentional?
Well, I think it's very clear that it's not coincidental that Mr. Snowden has taken up residence in Russia. I don't think that's purely chance. Look, I think the Russians are masters of what they call active measures, which is propaganda. And we've been through this before, if I can provide a little bit of history. Back in the mid-1970s, you had the case of Philip Agee, who was a CIA, former CIA officer whose career had turfed out due to his alcoholism, who actually pitched the KGB on what he knew, and they turned him away because they felt he was a flake, frankly, which he was. And the Cubans picked him up, and this led to years of pain for the Central Intelligence Agency in the 1970s, where Mr. Agee wrote three books. Well, actually, it was the KGB writing the books, but under his name, exposing KGB CIA operations, I'm sorry, in primarily Latin America. And so
it resulting in not a few of our agents getting killed in the process.
People died. Mr. Welch, CIA station chief in Athens, was murdered in 1975, partly due to the information that Mr. Agee blew, frankly. Several hundred CIA officers had their covers blown. This is a very serious matter. In fact, the U.S. Intelligence Identities Protection Act, which was the source of so much fun during the Bush administration with Valerie Plame, was actually put in place because of Mr. Agee, because he blew several hundred people.
But coming back to Snowden, the other piece of this, and again, John, your time in the National Security Agency, as well as working on counterintelligence activities, I've got to believe sheds light on this. But talk a little bit about the fact that what I regard as an intentional media campaign is indeed made worse by this kind of serial release of information. It's truly a death of a thousand cuts. This must be horrifically difficult for the agency to contend with, for morale of its personnel, and you know, for containing the damage in the future.
Yes. I mean, frankly, SIGIN programs have been burned here. The loss is massive.
Signals intelligence, right?
Yeah, signals intelligence, I'm sorry. It will take years, if not decades, to undo some collection that has been lost because of this may never be gotten back. That's the painful thing about signals intelligence. It's not like human intelligence.
Yeah, it's sources and methods compromised or gone forever, perhaps.
Gone forever. And we've been down this road before, but the scale of this is unprecedented. And obviously the morale hit is frankly vast. I mean, this is a kind of body blow across programs for NSA that does not have real precedent. And it's, you know, when I was working counterintelligence for NSA, frankly, I, among others, feared exactly this sort of thing happening, where a defector would wind up in the hands of a competent foreign adversary and devise a very clever propaganda campaign using some, you know, journalists and activists who are witty and some certainly who are not, who are, I believe Lenin called them useful idiots, who are setting up an international network to, as you said, death by a thousand cuts. This is going to go on for months, probably years. We may even only be at the beginning of this.
Yeah, that's my real fear, is that there's a lot more to come and possibly more damaging. Just drill down with me for a moment, if you would, John, on what it has meant to have this, again, serial assault on the relationship between the United States and a number of, if not outright allies, certainly relatively friendly countries, by virtue of these leaks by Snowden that there is monitoring going on of conversations, including among leaders of those countries. Is this, to be frank, I must tell you, I regard a lot of the protests coming out of these countries as the kind of shocked stuff we come to know from Casablanca. But what kind of damage do you think has been done to our relationships there, and will it be enduring as well?
I think some of the damage will be enduring. I'm frankly mostly concerned at this point about the fate of American IT companies abroad. There's going to be, in reaction to this, overreaction to this, an attempt to punish American companies who are alleged to have been in bed with NSA. And that really affects their economy. And that's a separate, very serious issue. I think on a bilateral relationship, on a diplomatic level, most of this will eventually be overcome. But it's highly embarrassing. The Germans don't protest too much, of course, right now, because the reality that's already come out is NSA has a close relationship with many, many foreign intelligence agencies, and one doesn't talk about these things, and now we're forced to talk.
Now we're talking about them. A lot of people are talking about
them. Now we're talking about them, and that's never a good thing when you get into detail. Certainly.
Yeah, well, and again, it goes back to compromising sources and methods. John Schindler is our guest, a former National Security Agency officer and currently a professor at the U.S. Naval War College, specializing in national security affairs. And John, quickly, little bit on this. What do you make of President Obama seemingly throwing the NSA under the bus, claiming that he was unaware of what these capabilities were and what use was being made of them? The agency leadership and the director of national intelligence say that ain't so. Is this politics as usual, or is this something that suggests, especially as it seems to be the leading edge of an effort to, on the part of the Obama administration, to impose some new restrictions on NSA, to do real damage to the agency from within?
I am certainly concerned here. The administration is not handling this perhaps as well as they could. Mr. Clapper, General Alexander, certainly spoke the truth, and they said, look, whether or not the president was aware of that, that's a different question. The president's a very busy man. Certainly, there were significant numbers of White House staffers on the National Security Council who were aware in detail of this sorts of collection. That simply, there's no getting around that fact. For the White House to pretend that they collectively, not necessarily the president himself, that they were unaware is just not, it's just not true. And I am concerned now, because I think now is the time where we need to get the message straight, frankly, out of Washington, D.C., not just to the American people, but to our allies abroad who are shaky, who are concerned. We've already heard from Israel. They're very concerned about our ability to keep secrets. As well they should be.
Rightly so, indeed. Last question. Does the bill that Dianne Feinstein in the Senate has offered strike you as walking that fine line, balancing critical capabilities while perhaps ensuring that abuses don't occur in the future?
I think Congress is going to act with due diligence here to see that there's enough reform to keep the American people happy while not fundamentally changing NSA's mission. But I got to tell you, Mr. Rogers, Representative Rogers from Michigan, who's the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, has said he's not willing to go that far. So I would not assume that Senator Feinstein's bill is going to pass as is. There's still a lot of politicking and horse trading to go on.
There is, and again, an awful lot of opportunity for mischief to be made and damage to be done. John Schindler, we'll look forward to keeping an eye on this with your good counsel, if you'll come back to us again very soon, if you would.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them.
When you make fun of them.
When you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaev's kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by our dear friend and distinguished colleague, Diana West, a regular contributor, I'm very pleased to say, to our deliberations here at Secure Freedom Radio, but also a syndicated columnist and a best-selling author, most recently, of American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. And Diana, you're always welcome, but particularly talk about betrayals, the
what happened last night in terms of several critical elections warrants some commentary by you. Let's start with, if we can, what happened to Ken Cuccinelli as the candidate for governor in Virginia.
I'm still reeling from this, from watching this, the results, watching the implications. Yes, this was certainly a betrayal by the Republican establishment. Another wedge between Republican mainstream and Tea Party groups. I mean, this was, you can feel the palpable animus that plays right in with the Democrats' game plan. And then, of course, we find out about the Libertarian spoiler having been greatly supported, chiefly supported by an Obama Democratic bundler. So, yes, this was a real dirty kind of action that worked for the Democrats. And when you look at the electoral map, I mean, it is so striking. It's on front pages today. I was looking at my Washington Post, and we see this sea of red in the state of Virginia, every county, but we look at the big city areas, and those are blue, McAuliffe blue, Obama blue, and it bespeaks to a tremendous divide. I mean, it's just a divide between the urban centers, the machines, and the people who live in the countryside. And this is a terrible thing to behold, probably with the implications down the road.
Big time. Don, let me ask you about the fact that the Libertarian candidate clearly siphoned off the margin of victory. This was a very close race, despite all of the polls going into it, which always makes me wonder about, whether there's a thumb on the scale of the pollsters in circumstances like this. But had the Libertarian not been in the mix, to say nothing of the Republican establishment helping the Republican candidate, this clearly would have been, notwithstanding, as you say, some strongholds in the machine apparatuses of the urban areas in Virginia, this would have gone for Cuccinelli comfortably. What does that tell you about the role that the Libertarians are playing at the moment in the politics of the right?
Well, they're feeding into Democratic strength. I mean, it does become a big, very important ingredient in any margin of Democratic victory. And if indeed it is supported by Democrats, this does call for some serious reflection on the minds of libertarians who actually do believe in free markets and want to see policies more friendly to free markets actually enacted. So this does become more of an issue for trying libertarians to think more of the Republican Party as a big tent for them rather than living out in the cold in a democratic, increasingly socialistic system that is total anathema to what they believe.
And this is all the more remarkable because I think Ken Cuccinelli was, by most standards, pretty much a libertarian himself. And to have been betrayed in this fashion by them is really very, very unfortunate, to say the least. Let's talk about another very unfortunate outcome in New York City. Bill de Blasio became the mayor of that city after, well, basically decades of sound Republican rule, more or less. What is in the offing under the new mayor?
This race, almost, if we can look at Virginia as the tragedy here, there is something farcical about the de Blasio victory in New York City. I mean, here is a man, the closest we have to a communist, running in a big, major, important election, and this does not seem at all radioactive to the public. And I think this, to me, is what interests me about it, that whatever findings about his support for the Sandinistas, his honeymoon in Cuba, Castro's Cuba, of course, his visit to the USSR in the Cold War, I mean, these kinds of just markers of a personality, of a bent, of an ideology, carry absolutely no threat or fear for the majority of the voters of New York City. And this, to me, is kind of the significance here of how these threatening policies to American liberty have become utterly neutralized as fear factors. And that, to me, is the most frightening notion that comes out of this race.
I was talking with Andy McCarthy about him a bit earlier in these programs, and Andy took the view that, you know, the problem basically is that the people of New York City have become so accustomed to reasonably competent management of their city and security most especially thanks to Ray Kelly, the commissioner of police, and the support that he's been getting from New York City mayors in ensuring that that city remains the safest, certainly large urban area in the country, if not in the world. That seems very much in jeopardy now, Dinah West, as a result of de Blasio's very, very different views on all of this and the takedown of the NYPD that seems now in the offing. Do you think there's likely to be buyer's remorse on the part of the people of the city of New York?
Well, the ingredients are certainly there. That does imply an act of violence against New York City or an uptick in attempts. And, you know, it does seem to certainly increase the potential for attacks on New York City. Yes, absolutely.
Mm. Diana, let me turn quickly to a couple of other things. You have been observing and warning and concerned, I know, about what I think of as Obama vote. This is an issue that we talked about a little bit last week as the unexpected, unanticipated, certainly by most of us, result of Obamacare, that it is being used as a mechanism for registering mostly low-income people and having them navigate the system, if you will, through the tender mercies of people like those Obama was meeting with today in Dallas. Talk a little bit about how this might, in turn, ensure outcomes like those we've seen in today's and yesterday's races now in New York and Virginia nationwide, if we're not very careful.
Well, the mechanism is there to register low-income voters, particularly those who qualify for Medicaid, not to participate in the so-called insurance marketplace themselves. At having self-declared an income level that is low enough, these applicants are automatically registered. They actually have to opt out of a voter registration process. And this is expected to enroll in heavily Democratic majority among these applicant pools in states that will then become a government dependent voter. I think that, you know, this becomes a reality we really have to confront, that people who are signed up through Medicaid will want to vote for whatever program it is that continues to pay out for them. I mean, this is a natural human instinct. If this is the mechanism that they have come into voting through, and this will likely become a supermajority in these states where we see this occur. I mean, it is a kind of a horrendous real life enactment of the old adage that when people realize that they can vote themselves increases out of the treasury.
Other people's money. They will do
correct.
It. They will
redistribution do it. Of wealth. You can do it democratically. You don't have to have a revolution.
Yeah. The revolution may be coming too. Dinah West, speaking of revolutions, I had hoped that we might have a little time to visit with you about your address to the Pumpkin Papers Society in Washington on Halloween. But that will have to wait for another day. I know that you have braced them up about some of the challenges that we're facing today, of very much akin to what we experienced in the past, documented marvelously by your new book, American Betrayal. But that's for another day. Come back to us again next week, and we'll talk with the rest of you, I hope, again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.